Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
And I'm missing the Patriots.
Aww.
We're recording this Sunday night. And the Patriots are playing the Seahawks where it's tied. So, anyway, prayers for Patriots running back James White. They just found out just before the game that his parents were in a bad car accident in South Florida. His dad died, and his mom was in critical condition. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, so
horrible.
Obviously the team, you know, let him go. My guess is the owner probably put him on his jet to head to Florida. So, prayers for them. So, let's talk about what's going on. What have we been doing? What have you been doing, Melanie?
What have we been doing? It's been a busy week of school.
School, yeah. And scouts and a one family event and no outings, though, right?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it just seems, yeah. The September weeks seem to go by so fast. It seems like just yesterday we were sitting here recording last week's episode.
Right? I know. Where does the time go?
So every year, September is the crazy month because it's when everything starts up again.
Right.
But it's also the month of various family celebrations. Although when the kids were younger, it was worse because there's a lot of the cousins have birthdays in September. And so there were a lot of family parties. Now that they're older, they don't want us to. they're in their 20s and such. They don't want us there.
We've stopped doing parties for every kid's birthday.
But it was crazy at the time. And of course, you can't get together with for anything anyway now anyway, but that's that. But what we have been doing, so Isabella and Sophie's scout troop has started meeting again. They meet at a Baptist church in the next town over, and we weren't inside, although I think they're allowed back inside now. But they were outside because they're earning their fishing merit badge, and so they wanted to do learn about the different pieces of the rod, you know, all that sort of stuff, and do practice casting.
Aha.
And so you can't do that inside. So, but this time of year, they start at 7 o'clock. So this time of year, it's dark by the time they get started. So so Adam, one of the assistant scoutmasters, he has this huge like construction lantern light thing.
Uh-huh.
That he brings on camping trips. I mean, it lights up an entire campsite. It's kind of impressive. And so he brought it in. So we're out in the dark fishing on the lawn.
Fun.
Yes, it was a lot of fun. And of course, Bella was there identifying stars and things like that as we looked. Oh, there's one of my favorite stars, Rigel 7. I don't know. She's going to laugh at me when she hears this because Rigel 7 is a planet from Star Trek.
Yeah, I actually this week I was calling upon her astronomy knowledge for the crossword puzzle. I said, star in such and such constellation.
Cygnus? Yes.
And she said, oh, it's Deneb.
I'm like, cheater. I had to figure that out on my own. So we do this, the Sunday Globe crossword puzzle every week.
Dom and I compete to see who can do it first.
Yes, some couples do crossword puzzles together as a bonding experience. No, we compete.
We're very competitive.
We're competitive. Only in that. That's the only thing we're really competitive in.
We used to do them together, but
yeah, when we were first married, when kids were very little, at dinner, I would have the Herald's crossword puzzle because that's when we got the Herald.
Actually, we started doing them back when we were dating. We would have dinner together and end up doing the crossword.
Now I remember that. Yeah. We would sit at the table and do the crossword puzzle together. It was
We were like an old married couple even before we were married.
That's right. I do the crossword puzzle every day at lunch. That's my thing.
I used to do it every day when I was young and had more time.
Yeah, I do it on the iPad with the pencil, which is awesome. I love doing it that way. So much better than trying to erase newsprint.
Yeah.
And I'm not one of those people who's like, I do it in ink because I'm, you know, really good. I'm not that good. So anyway, back to the topic. So they did their fishing merit badge, and it looks like they're going to try to do a camping trip this fall and some other stuff like this. Even with the restrictions in place, they're going to figure out ways to keep the kids involved, keep them going, which is great. I'm so happy. Bella loves being a scout. It really shows. And I really feel like she could go all the way to Eagle Scout.
I hope she does. That would be fun.
I've been looking at these news reports about the first girls becoming Eagle Scouts in some of the
already?
Profiles. Yeah, because they started some, they had to do a test run with girls in Scouts. So these are the girls who started early. And if they're older, like the secret is it's not as hard to get an Eagle Scout as it used to be. Like when I was a kid, I mean, I never earned it, so I'm not bragging, but it was a lot harder. It was much more rigorous to, like, there was a lot more merit badges and other stuff to get there.
Uh-huh.
So there was fewer kids that made it. And I think the BSA decided you got to balance the elite status of it and thus the desirability versus the benefits of being an Eagle Scout, of having accomplished it. So they've lowered the bar a little bit to make it a little easier. Which I think is fine. I think it's fine. So more kids are doing it. So it's you can get it done faster too. Like if it used to be, if you didn't start Scouts at 11, you know forget about it. It was, unless you were a crazy workaholic, there was no way you would make it by 17. Whereas now you can come in a couple years older and make it. So that's good. So I'm hopeful that she and Sophie. Heck, I think it would be awesome. Imagine if all five of our kids became Eagle Scouts.
Wow.
That would be wow.
You're not ambitious at all.
Not at all. I mean, I'm not one of these like, sports parents who wants all his kids to be in sports and all that sort of stuff. But I love the idea that because Eagle Scout scouting is a good thing. There's good, so much good in scouting, so much good for them that I would love to see them go all the way through, get all the most out of it that you can. So, that said, I'm now the Weebelows Den leader for Anthony's Weebelows Den. And so we've just gotten started again. I've been struggling a lot. I might have mentioned a few times I've been struggling a lot on how to do this under the current conditions. So I think what we've settled on is we've always used to meet two times a month. And so we're going to keep meeting two times a month, the one on Zoom and one in person, socially distanced with masks and the whole thing, and figuring out how to do that. I don't know what we're going to do when the winter rolls around and we can't meet outdoors anymore, you can still do stuff outside. It's not that bad, but you know, there's certain outdoor things, but there's certain things you got to be indoors for. And I think the church where we usually meet might start making it available. The Episcopal Diocese in Massachusetts has really locked down their churches.
Right, they're still not doing in-person services, are they?
No, they're doing parking lot and
Facebook.
And Facebook. Yeah, live stream. Yeah, the diocese has really locked them down, apparently. But the Baptist church may let us start meeting there, too.
Let the Cubs meet
on a temporary
too.
Basis, we could maybe meet in one of their spare rooms. So that might work out. We have to get, there's all kinds of permissions and that sort of stuff, but right. That might work out. So we had our first Zoom Doom meeting.
The Doom of the Zoom?
We had our first Doom meeting. No, Den Zoom meeting, which went okay. The kids were fairly attentive.
Of course, they're all used to doing it at school.
Exactly. I was missing three of the boys. They couldn't make it. Two of them are the more rambunctious of the boys, so that might have helped a little bit with the not being too crazy. But they're actually getting better as they get older, frankly.
Yeah, it's mellowing.
They're going to mellow out. They're going to settle down. And so next Saturday, we're going to meet here at our house in our backyard, learning to do outdoor cooking. We're doing our cast iron chef. It's not a badge. It's a pin. It's a venture. I can never get the terminology right. It's a pin. Anyway, so that's what we're doing. And then, but today we had a family celebration that was somewhat unexpected.
Yes.
We, my, So we've mentioned before, my nephew is a second lieutenant in the Army, just commissioned, and he was commissioned a couple months ago, and he's going to become a helicopter pilot, and his orders to go to Fort Rucker, Alabama, had him leaving a week from Friday, I think it was, a week from this coming Friday, as you listen to this, as it releases, this coming Friday. He was supposed to be there a week from then. Well, change in orders, because that's how the military works. We need you here a week early. So instead of, you know, having an extra week, he now has 3 days.
Right.
He and my brother are driving down on Wednesday and to arrive there in time for him to be Friday, where he will then spend 2 weeks in quarantine in a hotel by himself.
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
I can't imagine like spending 2 weeks alone in the hotel room.
I expect very long phone calls with his girlfriend.
FaceTime. No phone calls. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so antiquated. Yes. Of course.
I mean, you would imagine that as paradise. 2 weeks alone in a hotel room.
I would have so many books loaded on my Kindle. And yeah, that would be like, awesome.
At the end of 2 weeks, you'd be like, I have a little cough coming on. I might need another 2 weeks of quarantine.
Get a little tickle in my throat.
Oh, yes. I think this, just to be safe, we have to be extra safe. So
that does sound kind of heavenly.
So the party, though, it was supposed to be this socially distanced, you know, appropriate party. The state rules are no more than 50 people. Frankly, you get my family in one room. That's nearly the whole thing. We were outdoors. We were in my brother's backyard.
Yep. They had a nice bonfire going and a good spread of snacks.
Some food, some barbecued pork, pulled pork. My other brother, Bernie, made. Which was really good.
And cake and cheesecake and...
Yep, some nachos and things like that. And a TV to watch the Tampa Bay Buccaneers game, because now apparently New England fans are also Tampa Bay fans because of Tom Brady. Mm. So, and then, John Paul was there, my nephew and his girlfriend, and we got a nice chance to chat with him a bit.
Yeah, it was nice.
And my sister Evie's family was there, her seven...
Eight.
Well, we weren't sure whether Kiara was there.
Right.
Right. So maybe seven of the eight or eight of the eight. Again, it's hard to keep track. As well as the child. They had one of my sister's kids has a new Baby Yoda doll. And it was very popular, let me tell you.
I was afraid that we might have to pry it out of Lucy's hand when it was time to go. She was quite attached.
She was quite, like, literally quite attached. But yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I have a feeling I know what someone's going to get for Christmas. Yes.
I think that's going on her wish list,
although,
for sure.
Who gets it? Her? Ben? That'll be tricky.
I could see some battles going on there.
So, but that was good. It was fun. And then there were some other people coming in. So they tried to space out like people over the day so there would never be too many people at one time. So there were some people coming in. So we figured it was the better part of valor. We were there, had been there for a little over an hour or so. And I think you think this is great. These rules, by the way.
I always, whenever we go to family events, I always say, well, we're just going to stay for a little time. But then once I'm there, I like get talking to people and you get talking to people and the kids are running around playing. And we almost always end up staying
hours and hours.
And then we get home
and all the introverts are wrung out
and we're exhausted. I mean, as it was, even just like an hour and a half,
yeah.
I was exhausted, but at least we had time to cook dinner. If we had like not had a little ticking clock, we would have like been ordering pizza.
Not again.
I did not want to order pizza again.
Yeah, which is, so we'll be talking about that in a second, why we had to order pizza. And we got home in time for the kids to watch Rebels and Clone Wars.
That's true.
That's become our Sunday pattern now, is that especially Anthony, he really needs to see Star Wars Rebels, Star Wars Clone Wars, one episode of each every week. He has become, it's overdone to say, people of extreme strict habits are OCD, but he's become very strictly regimented in the things he needs on a regular scheduled basis. Several of our children are quite this way, in fact. So, so he needed to see Rebels and Clone Wars. Speaking of kids' schedules, I'll spring this one on you.
Okay, I have no idea where you're going with this.
Ben came up to me just before we started recording, before he went to bed, and he asked me, Daddy, can you change the do not disturb on the phone so that I can start reading his ebooks, his, you know, from the library ones, the Libby, earlier? Because I have it set so it won't, he can't access the phone but before 7:30. Like, so it's 7:30
in the morning?
Yeah, but 11, so from 11 p.m. to 7:30 in the morning, the phone was locked down. So I'm like, sure. Okay, I'll change it to 6 because, you know, that's when Sophie gets upset. I'm so when you're going to go, can you do it a little earlier? I'm like, really? Okay, I guess we could do it to 5 and then, you know, you'll get up after that. He goes, well, sometimes I'm up before 5. Do you know that he gets up before 5 sometimes?
No, I did not know this. What? Like,
buddy, you need your rest. You need to.
That's too early.
So when's Sophie getting up? Is she getting up before 5 too? Like, neither of us are up before 6. I'm up, like, at 6:30 at the earliest.
I got the impression that he was getting up, but not, like, getting out of bed. He's
getting up and probably he's laying in bed and listening to.
Right, because he doesn't want to interfere with Sophie, that's why he wants the phone to be unlocked so he can.
So I set it to, I really felt, you know, a little weird letting him, you know, setting it to 4 a.m. But I said, buddy, I don't want you getting up at 4 a.m., okay? I'm setting to 4 a.m. just in case you, because I also don't want him to have to, like, lay there unable to sleep, frustrated, you know?
Okay, but I want to know if he's actually accessing it at 4 a.m. because then we need to talk to the doctor or something.
Yeah, I think there's a way of keeping track of when he's using it.
Okay.
It'll say. Yeah, so it was like, if he's, buddy, like, we need to talk to him, like, why can't you sleep? Why are you having a hard time sleeping? Because he's not going to bed that early. He's going to bed at after 9 o'clock most nights. So, or 10, like even 10. So, yeah.
Although I have noticed that he's been really tired at bedtime recently. Yes. And like
even at dinner,
like almost asleep when his head touches the pillow. Yeah. So
he's like tired and cranky at dinner. And that I can see why now.
If he's getting up at 4 a.m.
No,
yeah.
Kidding. What are you going to go? Like, you going with Uncle Bernie to go grab the truck? Like, what are you doing?
Things you don't know about your children.
Yes. Sophie and Ben are the early birds, the morning larks.
Oh, Anthony's starting to become an early bird. He was quite distressed the other day when he woke up at 8. He's like, oh, it's 8 o'clock already. I'm so late.
I mean, Mr. FOMO, Mr. Fear of Missing Out. Yeah, I can see. all right. So, yeah, so that's what's been going on. Oh, one other thing. This is sort of in the school learning section. But you do read alouds to the kids every day, every weekday. And you reached a milestone. You finished The Lord of the Rings this past week.
Yeah, I thought we were going to talk about that when we were talking about books.
But we are. Well, we're talking about with the learning in school.
Okay. Yeah. We started back in March, and I think we started, like, we had one book that we were reading for our Lenten read, and then we finished it, and then we started Lord of the Rings as sort of, like, I don't know, let's march through the pandemic lockdown with Lord of the Rings, I think was my thinking way back when. Anyway, we started back in March, and so it took us a good 6 months, I would say, to read the entire Lord of the Rings. We pretty much did a chapter a day. There were a couple days when we would split a longer chapter into two parts. But on average, we did a chapter a day.
And so it was only since March?
Yeah.
Wow, it seems like it's been a lot longer than that.
It's been a long time since March.
I guess. I mean, I thought it was like last year or whatever. But
no. Okay. It was this spring.
It was interesting to hear you read the Grey Havens chapter. Spoilers. If you haven't, I don't know who you are if you're listening to this and you haven't seen or read Lord of the Rings, but you should. And if you haven't, skip ahead about a minute and a half. But just to hear the you read that chapter again, as I was, you know, preparing my lunch, the Grey Havens, and just how profound that chapter is. And I'm remembering my feelings when I first read that 40 years ago, almost.
Right.
And just the impact of that moment, it's the perfect combination of both joy and sorrow, you know, that you're going, I mean, it's a funeral moment, right? It's that my sorrow at our parting, but my joy that you will be at peace and going on to something greater.
Yeah, it kills me.
Yeah, yeah.
Every day. The ending of that book, oh my goodness, it's just so good.
Or with Sam going
when
back.
Sam, oh, I cannot read that the final line.
I heard.
Without my voice just totally cracking. My eyes are like very teary.
Sam sitting down to his dinner.
I'm home.
And the baby putting his lap in. Yes, I'm home. Oh, I get verklempt just thinking about
it. Yeah. I'm a little misty-eyed right now.
Best book ever, ever.
It is. It's so good. So very good. In so many ways. Every time I read it, I see something new and different. Although this time I really felt like there were a lot of things that I remembered as being taking very long that felt like they went by really quickly.
When you read it aloud, it went by aloud, very quick?
Well, this time reading it aloud, like Moria, just like, it felt like we flew through there. Yeah. Zoom, zoom, zoom. Okay, we're done.
So to speak, because the flight through Moria. Right.
But I remember when I was a kid, I remember that just feeling like it took forever.
I always thought the Dead Marshes took forever, like getting across the Dead Marshes.
That too. But like, again, that was like, it was like one day's reading.
One day's reading, and then they're on the other
when
side.
When you do it, you're right. When you do a chapter a day, like, I think that it must have taken me a lot longer.
Right.
Subjectively, at least, when I was younger.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. Same here. That and the crawl across the plains of Gorgoroth.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that one still gets me.
Mm.
When Sam starts, like, he's thirsty and he's given the very last drink of their water to Frodo, unbeknownst to Frodo.
Yes.
And then Sam starts daydreaming of every body of water in the Shire that he's ever seen, bathed in, drunk from. And just how beautiful and how poignant. And the fact that you don't even hear about Rosie Cotton until they're marching through Mordor.
Right.
And Sam starts to like remember her. It's like she's completely forgotten until they're in the depths of it. And then suddenly she's the thing that he's holding on to. And when you find out, when they get back to the Shire, she says, well, you took long enough. I've been waiting for you.
Right.
And you realize that there was something going on between them that you had no idea about through most of the book.
The restraint that Tolkien shows. And that's what it is. There's a restraint in it. There's a sort of English propriety about the restraint he shows in the relationships in The Lord of the Rings.
I know a lot of people feel very frustrated by the role of women, that women don't get enough play in Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And like Rosie Cotton and Arwen are there, but they're very much sort of subdued. And even Eowyn,
mm-hmm,
while she has a great role to play, she's fairly...
And Galadriel.
Right.
Well, in fact, you have the different kinds of women. Like, Arwen is royalty. You know, she's a princess. And so the relationship between her and Aragorn is that fairy tale princess relationship. Eowyn and Faramir, again, spoilers, so you skip ahead again because we're past that minute and a half I told you to skip ahead. Skip ahead again. Eowyn and Faramir, that's the courtly romance.
Oh my goodness, I did not realize until this reading actually how much the encounter between Eowyn and Faramir reads like an Arthurian romance.
Yes. Yes, and that's exactly what he does. Is it's courtly romance.
It's right out of Mallory.
And then you have Rosie and Sam, and it's just regular middle class folk. You know, just regular. This is who, you know, how people are. So I think he kind of covers the different kinds of romance in literature. So, yes, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So what do you want to know? Have you picked one?
Yeah, right now we're reading, we went from very big to very small. We're reading Warrior Scarlet by Rosemary Sutcliffe, which is a historical novel set in Bronze Age Britain.
Nice.
Which I think has, it's a very different sort of story, but it's got a little bit of that sort of ancient epic feel to it. I mean, it's a mm-hmm. small story. It's about a boy who wants to be a warrior, but he was evidently born with a birth defect. So he only has one working arm. The other arm he can't really use.
Yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't occur to him he can't be a warrior. Like, it's just his arm's always been that way, and he's always assumed that he was going to be a warrior until one day he accidentally overhears his grandfather talking, and he's crushed at the idea that he isn't going to be a warrior. He's just going to have to go be a shepherd.
Huh.
Anyway, that's as far as we've got in the story, so I won't spoil it. but it's really good. I love Rosemary Sutcliffe's historical novels. I know I've talked about her before, and it's just, they're good.
All right, we'll get to what we've been reading in a bit. But first, let's talk about what we've been eating. One thing that we weren't eating, which I've alluded to previously, is our homemade grilled pizza. We've talked about how we make homemade grilled pizza before. And you buy these pre-made pizza rounds at the store. Do they come in the refrigerated section or
on the
shelf?
They're just on the shelf.
Okay.
It's the same brand. I can't remember the brand name. Anyway, it's the same brand. They make naan too.
Yeah. We've made naan pizza before from this, from their,
but then I realized one day that they actually had
pizza rounds.
Yeah. Pizza crusts. And so I got them and I really like, they kind of crisp up nicely. And so
yes,
I started
getting
those
stone over the grill.
But this week we were very disappointed. I had bought them the week before and then we just hadn't got around to cooking them.
So we
had, normally I would freeze them, but the freezer was really full and I didn't have room. So I just had left them sitting in the kitchen.
You made a big pot of sauce. I got the grill going. I get all the stuff ready on the next to the grill, open up the first package and see mold. And mold on all of them.
And the second package and the third package.
And it's like, we don't have time to cook something else. It's dinner time. And, because it was Tuesday night and it was the scout meeting we had to go to. So it was like there was no time. So we ordered pizza from our local pizza place we always order.
It was
from.
Not what I wanted for dinner.
No.
I wanted homemade pizza and it was very disappointing.
It is. I mean, Corner's pizza is fine, but we wanted to have our own grilled pizza. So this goes to show that not everything always goes right for us either. In fact, we quite often have things that don't go right. So that was the moldy pizza rounds. But one thing we had that we haven't had in a long time, I made this week was the Vietnamese meatball lettuce wraps, which is
they were very good.
I think that's an America's Test Kitchen recipe.
Maybe.
It's really good and it's fairly simple. I think.
I'm not sure. I think they're simple. Okay.
Straightforward. They're not complicated,
I guess.
Let me see if I can find it. The recipe here. I can read it. I should have had it open earlier. So there's a couple different ways you can go with it. That's one of the things I like about it is you could either go like Vietnamese meatball lettuce wraps, or if you get some watercress, you can make Vietnamese meatball and watercress soup.
Is the meatball recipe the same for both of those? I thought they were slightly different.
Like, so the lettuce wrap ones, it's from Milk Street, by the way, Milk Street. 177milkstreet.com. So the meatball lettuce wraps, it's ground pork, cilantro, which didn't have enough cilantro, so we added in some mint and Thai basil from our garden.
Which was actually really good.
It might actually have been better. I think it was really good.
I think so. Liked especially that basil flavor. Oh, basil and mint is so good together.
I'm so glad that Thai basil plant came back and survived. It's about to die this week with the weather, but I'm so glad it was there.
Yeah, it pretty much, I thought, was dead after we got back from vacation.
Yeah, no, I'm glad it's there. So black pepper, scallions, fish sauce, and is there the fish sauce? I don't think so. In the meatballs, it's pork, water, cilantro, ground pepper, scallions, fish sauce, and a little bit of sugar mixed together. Boom. So in the watercress soup version of it, it's pork, scallion whites, an egg white, fish sauce, ginger, salt, and white pepper.
So I guess in this soup, you need the egg whites to make them stick because otherwise they'd fall apart soup.
Right. And there's no sugar, so it's not sweetened.
Right. Yeah, because sweet in a soup would be kind of odd.
I think in fact that the sugar would really come out. I don't know. If you did it, I don't know that would be bad. Frankly, the ginger in the other one might be pretty good if you had the ginger in the other one.
I could see that.
Might try that. But this was the lettuce wrap, so And then you make a sauce with more fish sauce, more sugar, sliced jalapeno, and lime juice.
The sauce is maybe the best part.
Yes, really good. You let that sit, and then it also has you grate some carrots, shred up some carrots, and add some of that lime juice fish sauce to it.
Basically, you're making like a carrot pickle.
Yes, and you serve it with that carrot, cilantro, the rest of the scallions, like the greens, and then you got bib lettuce for the wraps.
Boston lettuce.
Boston lettuce, right. They recommend bib lettuce, but Boston lettuce works too.
The leaves were a little small. I mean, I would have liked, I think, ideally to have something that with a bit bigger leaf.
And maybe a second head, because it goes pretty quick.
Yeah. That's the problem with, like, having room in the fridge for two heads of lettuce.
Luckily, we left the lettuce out because we were making the meatballs right away, so.
The same day as I went to the store.
Yeah, so. But yeah, that's the problem.
Which was actually nice because going to the store completely wipes me out. And so having you make dinner that night was actually really nice.
And I made rice to go with it, even though, you know, when we ran out of the lettuce, you could just have it on the rice and it was good.
Yeah. And not all the kids. Most of the kids, in fact, don't actually wrap them in the lettuce wraps. They just
eat them with the rice.
Eat meatballs with rice.
It was really good. Really good. I really like that recipe. I like both. I like the soup. Bella loves the soup. I really like the soup.
Yeah, we pretty much just like whatever they have. Like if they have watercress in the store,
then it's the
soup. We make the soup. And if they don't, then we'll just make lettuce wraps.
I mean, the soup has you add onion and garlic and chicken broth and watercress. And otherwise, that also has lime juice. They're both Vietnamese, and so they have the same basic flavors in it. So really good. So that's one recipe that we had this week. I'll put a link to the Milk Street, although you have to be a subscriber to get it, but I'll put a link to the both recipes anyway, in case you are a subscriber or become one. Maybe get a trial subscription. It's worth it. I like it. I like Milk Street. One thing we talked a few weeks ago about kids' food strategies that have proved out for us. And one of the ones we forgot that we talked about afterwards was, we don't make the kids' lunches for them.
That's mostly just laziness on my part.
But frankly, as we see other parents like struggle at this, every day I have to homeschool them, and then I've got my work to do, and then I got to make dinner and lunches. And it's like, why are you making lunches for them?
I think some people, one insight a friend of mine had this week is that frequently when you see somebody who does something that feels like it's kind of over the top, most of the time people do it because they like it. Like some people really, I think, enjoy.
Even if they complain about it?
Right. I think so. Some people really like making three hot meals a day and sitting down like all together for three times a day. I've just kind of too lazy to do that. Like I just want to, make dinner and then
they can get food and feed themselves.
I mean, I do end up sometimes helping with lunches frequently.
Right. But sometimes it's directing children to there's this, and this.
But most of the time, I sort of step back and let them forage. Either they eat leftovers or they make a sandwich or,
There's always cold cuts. There's always peanut butter and jelly. There's always mac and cheese. They can make pasta if they need to. They know how to cook their own pasta. Lucy knows what she can have, although she often has to be directed toward things.
I mean, she's 7.
Yeah. But Bella and Sophie know how to feed themselves. They're teenagers.
And frequently one child will make something that multiple children will eat, too.
And Anthony knows, like, for example, how to make pasta and for himself, and makes pasta and has it with sauce. And
right. I mean, he frequently will like make pasta and then Sophie and Ben will like
jump in
and have some pasta too. Can we have some of the pasta that you made?
So if you feel feeling overwhelmed and making lunches for your kids is not a thing that you love to do.
Do not feel guilty about making your kids make their own lunches.
Yes,
my mom made us make. I mean, we weren't
over after a certain age, though. I think that's the thing. After a certain age, they can make their own lunch.
But, I feel like we started like having Bella make her own sandwiches when she was like 6 or something.
All the stuff was where she could reach it.
Yeah.
The peanut butter jelly tortillas.
Yeah, but both a combination of like wanting her to be self-sufficient, and being lazy, but also, you know, being inspired by reading about like Montessori method, which is very much about empowering children to do for themselves, especially even small children.
Right.
Even a 3 or 4 year old can be taught how to put peanut butter on a piece of bread.
Right. Exactly. Although I think
they'll make a mess.
We need to retrain Anthony because he's put like half a jar on his.
Well, there's the how much do they put on is a different question.
Or the jam. Oh, the really good Summer's Bounty jams. But that's a whole nother question.
Yeah.
I had also wanted to add a grilling tip, which is also a household maintenance tip. One of the benefits of, I'm calling it a benefit, one of the benefits of charcoal grilling over propane grilling is that with charcoal, you end up with ashes. And you're like, why is that a benefit? You get ashes now, they're dirty, they're messy, you got to get rid of them. So when they're cool, don't ever do this when it's hot, you let them sit and cool. When it's time to dump the ash bucket that all charcoal grills have, dump it in your trash and you will... A, because it's charcoal, it will absorb odors. So this is our outdoor trash, not your kitchen trash. It'll make a mess in your outdoor trash barrel. And it will kill bugs like flies and, you know, maggots and stuff. Sorry, I hate maggots too. But it will.
This was purely accidental. Serendipity?
Serendipity.
You just like had started. We had had really bad problems with infestations in our trash can, and then
in the summer it would stink to high heaven.
It would be gross. You'd have to like hose it out with like all the
after the trash has been taken. Sorry for eating lunch.
And then we also had a lot more flies coming into the house, but since you've started dumping the ashes, we do not have to
hose the barrel out, and we have a lot fewer flies around. I used to dump the ashes behind the shed in the back corner of the yard, like it was like with the where I put the, you know,
right,
branches had fallen off of trees. But now it's like, this is gold. This is perfect. So, charcoal ash, you know, what you don't want to do, by the way, is mix it with water to get it wet.
No,
because ashes and water makes lye, which is an acid that will.
No, it's a base.
I'm sorry. It's a base that will burn skin. And so don't be careful.
You could make soap.
I worry sometimes about the ashes that are underneath the grill, like when it rains, that it might be. You got to be careful. Kids going out there with bare feet. So I got to make sure I clean that up on a regular basis. So that's what we had to talk about for food and cooking and eating and things and related topics. My brother was trying to convince me that I needed this. He's got a new combination charcoal propane smoker grill that he wants to be. He's like, oh, dude, when it's time to buy a new one, I have to think about getting a new grill because my faithful trusty Weber has developed. It's 14 years old and it's developed a rust hole in the bottom. I'm kind of sad. This trusty grill is on its way out, but I have to think about getting a new one. And he was like, oh, you know, get this. This is awesome. But I'm looking at it going, the charcoal grill part is really small. And that's what I'd be using most of the time. I mean, I really want a smoker, but
your brother and you have very different houses. First of all, he's cooking primarily for two people, right. Whereas you're cooking for seven people.
Yes. And he's doing a lot more smoking than grilling. I think.
Whereas we might use a smoker, but we still would grill more than we would smoke.
They have, I think, the one company he was recommending, they make an offset smoker. And I think they have one that's just grill, like charcoal and smoker. But I still think the grill part is small. So maybe I'll maybe I can get a Weber grill, just the grill, charcoal grill, and see whether the Weber grill and the smoker combined are less than or comparable to just the smoker. Because just the smoker itself was like $550. Like the one that Bernie was recommending was $550, which,
ouch,
it's not that expensive for a grill these days, but it's a little more than I really want to pay. Like to replace the one we've got would be about $300. So I don't know. I really wanted a smoker. I guess I'll have to wait. So if anybody knows of a good combo smoker charcoal grill that has a big grill plate, like a grill place to grill food on over the charcoal, let me know. I would really appreciate that at betts@sqpn.com because I'm in the market. Anyway, let's talk about what we have been reading and watching
Okay. Who goes first?
I'll go first because I've got two things I've been watching. Then we can talk about reading stuff.
Okay.
First one. This will be quick. I watched on Netflix Cobra Kai.
What's that?
So it was a YouTube show, a couple seasons, and then it ended up on Netflix. Yeah, YouTube TV. It was a YouTube.
Okay.
So YouTube, like Google, was paying money to make a professional show. This is the sequel to Karate Kid, starring Ralph Macchio.
And
the Cobra Kai dude.
They made a sequel with Ralph Macchio. Like,
Ralph Macchio. And the actual other Cobra Kai dude.
How old was Ralph 50. Macchio?
50. They're like my age now.
So is like Ralph Macchio like the he's the sensei? Like,
well, no, he owns a car dealerships. He's really successful car dealership, and we're chopping the prices. You know, hiya.
No,
yes, the guy who was the kid who sweeped the leg, Johnny. That's what it was.
Uh-huh.
Sweep the leg, Johnny. He's like a broken man. He's a failure at life. He's a loser three times over. Can't keep a job. Down on his luck, you know, all this stuff, and he's resentful of Johnny, what's his name?
I do not remember. It's been so long since I said this.
The Ralph Macchio's character's name. Oh, I know it. Anyway, I can look it up. Anyway, he's resentful of his success, and he ends up blah 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 blah. By the end of the first episode, he's opening up the Cobra Kai dojo. To start teaching kids how to do karate. My guess is there will be a rematch between Johnny and...
No.
Oh, I thought I would get it that time. I don't remember the name. So, the acting's not great. The writing is really contrived. But it's pure nostalgia. The music is pure, right out of the 80s.
It wouldn't nostalgia just be watching the original movie?
No. Like nostalgia, it's pure nostalgia, yes, would be to watch the originals again. But this is enjoying, this is you sit down with your buddies having beers, like, what would have happened to Johnny, you know, if he were alive today, you know, if he were around today? Where would Johnny have ended up? This is where Johnny would end up. Loser! I'm just kidding. But like I said, the acting is not great. Even Ralph Macchio's acting isn't great. But you know, it's all right. It's worth watching so far. I mean, I've only watched the one episode, so it was worth it. The other thing I watched on Netflix was something called High Score. It's a documentary series, a limited series. It's purportedly telling the history of video games. It's highly selective in its history. I mean, it hits the high points of this is the guy who invented Mario, and this is the guy who invented Sega and Sonic the Hedgehog. And this is Richard Garriott, who's a big name in role-playing adventure games. He created Ultima, you know, the guy who was behind. Like, they have it's both mostly American and Japanese guys, and they go back and forth interviewing them. They have the guys behind, they kind of go over time from the very earliest games, and they get up to the last one I watched. They got up to the Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat and the fighting games and the controversies over violence in video games. The thing that gets me though, it's got this real politically correct agenda that they're pushing. I hate to say it. It's very entertaining otherwise, but there's this agenda that they're really pushing where they keep bringing in these very unimportant, like people in, they're not, there are no unimportant people. I mean, people who aren't really a big deal in the history of video games. Like, they didn't make a big game. Like, they're just like these little people who they have one commonality, which is they represent a minority or oppressed group. So you have the one black programmer who worked for this one console game company who they say invented the video game cartridge, when in fact the reality is he didn't invent it. He just worked on an iteration of it. It was actually invented before him. But then they have this transgender guy who as a boy won this huge Mario Brothers, I think it was, contest for best gamer, and it's a big deal. So, you know, the big deal is that he's transgender, and it, and then the worst one was this guy who created this nothing this video game that nobody's ever heard of called Gay Blade, which was the first LGBT first third person shooter action game that has disappeared. He lost, and so it's lost forever and no one can ever see it. But it was, they were taking really wild swipes at religious belief, like the religious right and Pat Buchanan. And I'm like, this is weird. Like, why are you doing, like, this doesn't have anything to do with the history of video games. This is way out there. It was really frustrating to listen to. So, you know, I would like to watch a documentary on video games, because for me, I played video games as a kid, but I missed all of the big things. I never had a Nintendo. I never had an Atari. I never had the Sega or any of those game systems. All my friends always did. And so it was kind of interesting to see that what I was missing out on as a kid. I mean, even now I don't have a PlayStation or an Xbox or anything like that. And I don't have a Windows PC, so I don't play any of the big PC games. I play whatever's on the Mac basically. So, I'm going to give that one like a 5 out of 10 for the, you know, thumbs up for the good stuff, but the weird agenda, politically correct agenda was, it really hurt the enjoyment of it. So to you,
Let's see. I've been watching very, very slowly, Endeavor,
which What's is, that?
It's a British murder mystery, police procedural. So I've never watched Morse, Inspector Morse, which is like a
very famous,
very famous, but like 80s, maybe 70s. I don't know exactly when it was. Anyway, Endeavor is like the prequel, like Morse when he's, you know, young detective, just like not even detective, young policeman.
Okay.
Just on the force, which I gather that there's a whole lot in it that, like, if you have seen Morse and are a big fan, like, this is all the, like, reveals about, like, the stuff about his, you know, youth. But as a standalone, like, not knowing anything about Morse, I'm actually finding it incredibly enjoyable. He's an interesting character. The mysteries are interesting and the production values are really high. So I've been having fun with that.
Okay.
I think it's on Amazon Prime. That I've been watching it. And then let's see. I've been reading. I finished a couple books this week. Woohoo!
Yay!
Finally, I finished Elijah of Buxton, which is a middle grade novel. So like maybe junior high. And it's a very interesting historical novel. Buxton is evidently a actually real historical community that was established by a Protestant minister as a haven for escaped slaves from the U.S. So it's right across the border in Canada.
Okay.
And Elijah, the protagonist and narrator, is the first child born free in the community. So all of the adults in his community are former slaves. But Elijah is born free. And so he doesn't know what slavery is like. And there's this really interesting sort of narrative tension where he's kind of naive and gullible. His mom and the other adults call him fragile. And I think partly he's fragile because he doesn't know what it is to suffer in the way they know, like they can't imagine. And so they both cherish his like innocence because it's such an accomplishment for their community. And yet at the same time, there's a little bit of frustration almost on their part at how easily he's taken in.
Right.
But I think he works really well as a narrator because of that innocence, because as the story goes on, the main plot is that a woman in the community who had been saving money to buy her husband's freedom gets a letter that, it turns out he's died. And it's really poignant because Elijah is one of the children can read, but the adults can't. And so he has to go with his mom to deliver the letter and read it to the grieving widow. And it's really, I mean, that's so poignant. He's a 12-year-old boy, like, having to read, and he's, like, so proud of himself for not breaking down and crying, even though he's fragile. But then, so then this woman takes the money that she had saved up to buy her husband's freedom and gives it to another man to buy his wife and children out of slavery. But a charlatan takes the money and absconds with it.
Okay.
And Elijah goes along with the man who's was going to use it to buy his wife's freedom to get it back.
All right, don't say too much.
I won't spoil spoilers. What happens, but the ending was just one of the most, it was sad, it was poignant, it was beautiful and hopeful all at the same time, like tragic and hopeful. And I thought that the novel really did a great job of both, in some sense, preserving the innocence of the narrator while yet being historically faithful to the horror and tragedy that slavery is. And so he loses some of his innocence. He, by the end of the novel, starts to see from the adult perspective, like he and his friends had played at being abolitionists and slavers.
Uh-huh.
That was sort of like their version of cowboys and Indians.
Right.
And he says by the end of the novel, I could never, having actually seen slaves in chains, I could never play that game again. So he loses some innocence.
Yeah.
But he also becomes an agent, an actor, like he has some agency in saving people. So there's that kind of hopefulness. It was a beautiful novel. I expected it to be hard, and it was. I wouldn't give it to a younger child, but Bella read it and she enjoyed it.
Right. So teenager.
Teenager, maybe 11 or 12, I think.
Depending
on... Ben and Sophie could probably handle it.
So, I mean, there are kids who are exposed to a lot more harder stuff. So I mean, there might be, it sort of depends on what your child is used to. But yeah, ours are fairly sheltered from.
Right. But, you know, people die. Bad things happen.
Peril.
There's lots of danger and peril and some really hard stuff.
Yeah.
But it was really hopeful too.
Good.
I really liked it.
Good. Elijah of Buxton.
Elijah of Buxton. I liked the title. Like the title really grabbed me and I wasn't disappointed.
So I finished another book. I finished because it's Dresden Files and they go quick. The fast food lunch, but a fast food lunch of really good food.
I binged the entire series in like a month at the beginning of the year. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I finished, this one was called Winter Night. I don't want to say too much about it, but I want to say something about Butcher and his treatment of moral issues. And I really, in theological issues, even like there is a fallen angel involved in the story, like a literal, a demon, one of the fallen angels. And Butcher is not a Christian writer. He's not a Catholic. I have no idea what his faith is. And he doesn't necessarily get all the Catholic stuff right. He's clearly coming at it from an outsider's point of view. But he treats it respectfully. And the things he does with this particular fallen angel and the questions of good and truth and temptation and evil and what does it mean to have free will... He does such a great job. Like this,
right? I thought the portrayal of temptation is one of the good ones in literature. I really appreciate it.
It was great. He really describes temptation like the temptation that of Christ in the desert. Like I don't know if he was intentionally paralleling, but it certainly feels like it there. And then because the temptation is never like, hey, get this evil thing. Yeah, you can do all this evil. It's always the temptation to do good with evil means. You're going to help people, right? Look, hey, this is a good thing. Help people. Just let me give you a little help with that. You know, you want me to help you a little bit, you know, and then questions like, he's kind of tied to the demon in a way, in a very surface way. I don't want to get into it because it's kind of a spoiler and it's complicated. But he has an injury to his hand, but he plays guitar and he has a tough time. And suddenly he's playing beautiful music, And he realizes it's because the demon is helping him because it's trying to be, you know, it's trying to ingratiate
like
itself
the,
with him.
Like the devil went down to Georgia.
Yes. But he's playing really beautifully. And I'm thinking, what an interesting thought. Can the devil create or a demon, because it's not the devil, a demon. Can a demon create beautiful music as in tempting, you know, through you to tempt you? And but in beauty, is that not an aspect of God? And so maybe I got to ask Jimmy. Well, this is going to be one of my weird questions. Right, questions,
but that is a theme in folklore, like the right. devil giving somebody the ability to play really well,
to play beautiful music, or to paint beautiful art, or create be accomplished. Right. Okay. So is the devil tapping, or the demon in this case, tapping into an aspect of the nature that it received from God?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, like
the injured nature it received.
Right. I mean, you think about it, they're still angelic beings in the way they were created to
right.
be beautiful and to co-create with God.
Yes.
So,
I mean, who would have thought a book about a noir private detective wizard would elicit, you know, discussions about truth, beauty, philosophy, temptation?
That's what my sister was telling me for years before I finally caved in and read yeah. the series. She's like, really, you have to read them. And my sister, the theology major.
Yes.
So she's, you know, always wanting me to read so she could talk to me about them. And it took me a while.
This was the ninth book, and he's got 16 so far.
Yes.
16 or 17.
17 is coming out
like,
this month.
This like literally has to be this week because there's only a week left of this month.
Yeah, I think it's on the 29th.
So if you do decide to read them, power through the first four or five of them. He doesn't really hit his stride in it till, I mean, they're enjoyable, but this sort of meatiness to it is starts showing up around book four or five, I think.
Yeah.
Because at first I was like, oh, I mean, it's all right. It's you know, it's fun. I'll keep reading them. But
I was just like, just you wait.
Just keep going. Just keep going. Once you get to book four or five, then it really, this sort of wrestling with morality and faith of a more general sense.
But do keep in mind that there are elements that would disturb more sensitive people in the books. And so they're yes. not. If you're the kind of person who's disturbed easily, don't. It's not
right.
for you.
There's monsters and evil creatures and battles and people being horribly injured and that sort of stuff. Zombies, vampires,
right, and people acting in immoral ways,
and also yeah, immorality, yes, that kind of temptation too. I mean, at one point he's working on the set of an adult film.
Right.
It doesn't, I mean, there are some jokes, some sophomoric jokes. That was the book I enjoyed least, frankly.
Right.
I think that was book four. Although there are elements that are really good that are vital to the rest of the series.
Right. Like you can't skip it because there's stuff in it.
A couple things. If you skipped it and you would be in the next couple of books, you'd be going, wait, who's that? What happened? I mean, there's some vital things that happen in it, but power through it if you can and get to the good stuff afterward. But yeah, that was the one I wasn't as. Was that summer? Was that summer? So the summer night?
No.
I think that was the summer night. No. It was not. Anyway, regardless, it was one of the first few books. So that was what I finished reading, and now I'm reading the latest book in the Mitch Rapp series by. Started by Vince Flynn, who has since passed on, but has been picked up. Oh, I can't remember the name of the author who's picked up the series. He's a assassin for the U.S. government, you know, hunting down terrorists, et cetera, et cetera. It's, you know, it's mindless entertainment. But I mean, I always enjoy it. I always have to read them when they come out. So that's what we've been reading and watching. Let's talk about today's gospel. That's a big switch.
Yeah, we like to keep you on your toes.
Yes. 25th Sunday in Ordinary Time. Today's gospel, just to refresh your memory, was about the landowner and the laborers in the vineyard. And how
I really like this gospel.
He violated the collective bargaining agreement. Just kidding. So, as just to, again, refresh your memory, he hired laborers at 9 o'clock in the morning or early in the morning at dawn, then went back out to the marketplace, found others standing idle in the marketplace, hired them, go to the vineyard, went at noon, went again at 3, went again at 5. They have long work days, and paid them all the same amount. And the ones who were there first thought they were going to get paid extra because the other guy's got a full day's wage. I should get extra. And he said, why are you grumbling? You know, it's my money. I can do it what I want. I thought it was interesting. Where did the guys at 9, noon, 3, and 5 come from? Where were they at dawn?
Right. Where were they? Were they still like, I mean, I could understand that maybe not being there at dawn, like, because you're sleeping in. But when it's 5 p.m., where have you been all day?
Right. Were they lazy? Were they working other jobs? Are they looking for a second
job?
Were they
drinking in the tavern and they finished all their, like, they went through all their money and now they're, like, looking for earning a few bucks? I mean, were they looking for work?
But I like this idea. So we'll talk a little bit about another approach that's very interesting, that from our friends at Mount St. Mary's Abbey's, the Trappistines, and the Mother Abbess there, that we often refer to her reflections on the gospel. But my reflection is just this idea of the guys who were there all day, the sense of entitlement that they have to the landowners, their boss's money.
Right.
You know, hey, you know, why are you paying us the same as the guys who only worked a few hours? We should get more. Why should you get more? I've decided to be generous. This is my money to do with what I want. Why should you get more? You got what we agreed on, you know, and this jealousy at the gods, to extend the metaphor to, because of course the landowner stands in for God. This jealousy of the blessings that God gives to others that we think we deserve more. You know, we've been faithful, God. Why do you take this guy who just showed up, this convert? Why is he getting all these blessings?
But I liked our pastor, Father Michael's point that he made at this point, which is that what is it that God is giving us? What are the gifts? I mean, what are the wages that he's paying us? Because it's not exactly wages, because what we get from God is the Holy Spirit. It's the best gift, better than the gift of life, even. Is the gift of the third person of the Trinity, which we all get. This weekend was our parish's confirmation. So I think that he was especially hitting that note, talking about confirmation and the gift of the Holy Spirit. But that we get grace, that we get mercy, that we get eternal life. I mean, how can we begrudge any other person those gifts from God, regardless of when they come to God, at the very last minute, like the good thief on the cross? God gives him the same mercy, the same Holy Spirit, the same eternal life. But do we really want to begrudge somebody and, you know, keep him out of God's kingdom?
Or I want more, like, that's fine, but you got to give me more then. It's right. Like the older brother and the prodigal son. You know, again, he's not just happy to have his brother back. He's like, well, what is, like, I did what you told me to do. I mean, they sort of begrudge that they're getting precisely what they deserve. You know, you get what you're supposed to get because you did what you were supposed to do. Like, the older brother's like, I could have gone off and been all that, like him, all wasting everything. But that would have been wrong. Like, what he did was wrong, but we're glad he's back.
Right. When I love the father's response to the older son, everything I have is yours. Like, I can't give you any more. You have the entirety of everything that I have.
Yeah. Your brother squandered his inheritance. So everything else is going to you. So what is it you actually are looking for? You've been also given a great gift. Your brother is back.
Right.
Your brother is alive again.
Right. So. And we too. We are getting God's kingdom. Like, we get the whole thing.
Right.
The whole kit and caboodle.
The wages we receive is the kingdom of heaven. So, so Mother Abbess, what's her name?
Mother Sophia.
Mother, that's right. Mother, how do I forget? Mother Sophia, being a Benedictine, she obviously takes a Benedictine approach to this one.
I really loved, she points out what I had kind of noticed. And noticed briefly, but she, of course, delves into it with a beautiful Benedictine penetration, that the times at which the landowner goes out seeking laborers are the monastic
hours of the divine office.
Right. Dawn 9, midday 3 and 5. And she says, who knows? Perhaps he was up at night, too. And so she says, the question is, who's really working?
Right.
Are the laborers working or is not the vineyard owner working? He's going out all day long to go recruit more laborers. He's really working hard here to gather the idle and the unemployed at Lauds, Terce, Sext, Known, and Vespers to gather them into his vineyard, as she says, into his church, into his kingdom, into his bosom. Day by day, week by week, year by year, and psalm by psalm, he is working, drawing all people to himself. So she says the work of prayer, the work of the monastery, who's doing the work? Is it the monks, the nuns who are praying the office? Or is not God doing the work of calling us into communion with him? And even for us lay people who aren't in the monastic life, we're still called to be workers in the vineyard. We're still being called.
Yeah. Our vineyard is our home.
Right. We're still being called to work and pray. Our proportions of work and prayer are slightly different than those of our brothers and sisters in the monastery. And yet we're still called to work and pray.
Right.
But I also liked the point, which I think was one that she made. Something that gets lost in translation is the translation we use says he promises everybody a day's wage.
Yes.
But Mother Sophia points out that the wage is one denarius.
Yes.
She says that there's a wonderful point here. One denarius is not just a little historical flavor to make us feel we're there in first century Judea, but the landowner, God, gives to each his most precious gift, his one and only son. So the one coin, yep, representing the one
son. No more, no less.
Right. I love that. Isn't that beautiful? Like, things that get lost in translation, like, we think, well, people don't know how much a denarius is worth, so let's translate it into something, a day's wage.
But when you over-translate things, you sometimes lose...
Sometimes the simplicity of, like, the denarius, which Jesus uses in other parables.
Show me the coin that you used to pay the tax.
Whose face is on the coin?
Right.
And I've seen other commentaries, like on the commentary of the Good Samaritan, like, the coin is often a representation of, like, whose image is on us.
Right.
God's image, hopefully. We are stamped in his image, like a coin is stamped with the image of the king.
Like the parable of the widow who loses a coin and sweeps her house for it. She's not being cheap. That coin is a day's wage. If you lost a 1 day's worth of earnings in your house somewhere, I darn well think you would tear the place apart looking for it.
And that reminds me that I watched a video a while back that was a commentary on an artist, and I can't even remember which artist. I think it was Titian. Mm-hmm. But he had done a commission for a coin collector of a painting that went on the cabinet where he collected coins. And the image that was on the cabinet was the parable of the coin. Jesus, you know, saying whose image is on this coin.
Right.
And the idea being that as he's looking at his coins, his rare and valuable coins, to stop and think, whose image am I bearing?
Right. Whose image is on me? The coin of me.
The coin of me. Right. Right. So I really like that idea of thinking about when coins show up in the Gospels, the idea of God's image versus Caesar's image.
Yes.
Really something to ponder.
By the way, the point that she makes about the denarius, she found in the book from Father Simeon Levi Marakakis, The Fire of Mercy, Heart of the Word. Mm-hmm. That's the book series that I used to use when we started that Bible study that you used to come to when we first met.
Interesting.
That I when we were doing the Beatitudes in that Bible study, that's mm-hmm. the book. Like, his study of the Beatitudes, his commentary on the Beatitudes is phenomenal.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sounds like something I should go read.
Yes. I recommend the book series. In fact, I remember going to a meeting with Father Fessio at Ignatius Press and telling him, when is the next volume of this coming out? Because this is so great. We're using it in our Bible study. And he was like, oh, wow. Yeah, sure. We're trying to get it soon. I mean, it was just, like he was kind of taken aback by how wonderful I was saying it was.
How excited.
Yeah. So good. I think that should do it. We've gone on enough for this time. A lot of fun. I think this was a good discussion we've had tonight. And so as we wrap up, I don't want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Jeanette F., Joseph S., Benjamin C., Bill and Joanna M., and James W. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. What did you think of our discussion? Or you have any questions or comments you'd like to share with us? You can do so at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And I'll put links from over all the books and shows and things like that we discussed in our show notes at sqpn.com. If you have not yet done so, you better go do right now. Subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, your favorite podcast app, or at the SQPN YouTube channel where you should hit the bell to get notifications. Amazon Music has podcasts now. Everybody's doing podcasts.
Everyone does.
So you should find us there soon. I've submitted our podcast there. We want to be everywhere there is podcasts. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.